is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
We never really got around to playing good basketball, and all of a sudden it was halftime, we were losing. Locker room's kind of quiet. Eventually the coaching staff comes into the room, and the first thing Tom Crean says is John Wokum, stand up. And I'm not even dressed for the game. So I'm wearing dress clothes, and I'm thinking, why in the world would this guy be calling me out? And so I stand up in the middle of a room surrounded by the rest of the team, and he basically just berates me about my performance in practice during the week and the fact that, you know, it was my effort, it was my screwing around, not understanding the game plan, not studying the scouting report. I didn't prepare, you know, our backcourt the way that I should have, blah, 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 and then he just storms out of the room.
John Wokum is a former Division I basketball player at Marquette University, who later earned his MBA from Loyola University Chicago. The co-founder of Playmakers Basketball, John implemented collegiate-level workouts into a basketball camp circuit, an AAU program, aimed to provide better opportunities to kids in the Midwest. Prior to his current role as an e-commerce executive, John worked with high school and collegiate athletic programs on the importance of proper nutrition and the development of fueling stations to enhance athletic performance. Widely recognized for his basketball passion, you can still find John coaching youth teams and playing pickup games at a local gym. John recently authored the best-selling book, Walk On Warrior, which details his basketball journey and the people and stories that made it worthwhile. John, his wife Allison, and their daughter Avery currently reside in Portland, Oregon, where John serves on the board of Portland State University's Center for Retail Leadership. If you leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts during the month of March, we'll enter you into a drawing to win an official Hoopheads Podcast t-shirt. Plus, your reviews help others in our basketball community find the show and become a part of Hoopheads Nation. Please enjoy this episode as you learn from the experiences of John Wokum, the author of Walk On Warrior. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are here with John Wokum, author of Walk On Warrior. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. We're excited to have you on the podcast, talk to you a little bit about your book and what inspired you to write sort of the memoir of your career. So let's start there and talk about what made you want to write the book. And the thing that I was most impressed with after I read it was the fact that you just had the wherewithal when you were a kid to write down some of the stories and things that happened to you. I wish I would have done that through my college career, because I think I could have wrote a pretty good book too.
I'm sure you could have. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy because I graduated from high school in 2003. And even then, bits and pieces during my senior year, I kind of started to journal some things, more so for myself. I actually started playing Division II basketball, Minnesota Crookston, which is about 20 minutes from the North Dakota border. And it's cold up there. And so when there's not a whole lot going on, I come back to my dorm at night and I just would kind of journal kind of the same types of things. And it got to the point with some of the activities that were going on, and then after I transferred to Marquette and earned a spot on the roster, that more and more things were just unique to me as a person, because they were just things I hadn't experienced before. And I also kind of started to think back in my own life of when I was in 7th, 8th, 9th grade. I always wanted to know what it was like, and I think a lot of us are like that. Like, tell me what a day in the life looks like at a Division I program. You know, how much time these guys actually put in. You know, how long is practice? I wanted to know some of those things. And so I thought, here I am. I've got an opportunity to actually document some of this stuff. And I'm not talking about anything that's privy to the locker room or anything that would upset anybody, but more just, I thought there's a lot of really cool stuff in here that could maybe inspire a kid just like myself that has aspirations to play college basketball at any level. And they're looking for the truth, really, is what it is. I mean, I read a lot of books, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and so many interviews now are so canned, and guys say exactly the same thing, and there's nothing wrong with that, but I think the real goal for my book was to be as authentic as possible, to tell the truth, and to kind of get into not only just what happened, but also how it felt going through some of that stuff. And the interesting part about it is, because it took me essentially 14 years to complete the whole thing, even kind of my tone through the book changes, because different parts of it were written at different times in my life.
Yeah, I know as I was reading through it, a lot of the things that
you wrote about, especially in terms of your time at Marquette as a Division I walk-on there, resonated with me as a former player at that level, because a lot of the things that, although they weren't exactly the same that occurred to me during my career, there were definitely similarities and things that I'm like, oh yeah, that reminds me a lot of the time when this happened. And we'll dig into some of those similarities as we go through the kind of your story. But to your point, the book is very much not canned. It's very much, I think, a realistic picture of what the basketball landscape looks like as you're kind of traveling through it from the time you're a young kid, you know, growing up kind of in the travel AAU system and then on in through your recruitment. And obviously you got a chance to play at a couple different levels, and then you go on from there and you're into coaching. And so you bring a unique perspective that, because you were able to take those notes and journal in the moment, I think a lot of people, you know, you look back and your memory gets fuzzy. And when you were able to write those things down right as they were happening, I think that's what made the book for me feel like, boy, that I could feel it happening right as I was reading it. And it took me back to some times when I was playing. So I really, again, I really enjoyed the book. So let's start, John, by going back to when you were a kid and talk a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball for the first time, what made you fall in love with it, and then kind of just the journey that you went on as a youth basketball player prior to high school, let's say.
So I grew up in central Wisconsin, in a small town called Marshfield, which is in the geographic center of the state. And Marshfield's not known for a lot. I think we've got the world's largest round barn. If you want to look that up sometime.
Nice. We're going to get on that.
We'll put
that in the show notes. There you go.
So not a whole lot going on there. Football town, farming community, but lots of really just hardworking people. And I think from an early age, I think the one thing that I look back on is just, I grew up around people that worked hard. And so even going to basketball camps, went to my first camp in first grade or so, I saw kids that worked really hard, but didn't necessarily have a lot of skill. And so, you know, obviously for me, I thought the way to separate myself is I just have to be more skilled than the rest of these kids. And so, you know, I was a very influential kid, probably just like most kids my age that way. But I went to camp and I was probably the only kid that actually went home and did exactly what the coaches told me to do, which is here's 20 minutes of ball handling, do it every day the entire summer. And when you come back to school in the fall, you're going to be a better dribbler. So I took that to heart. I did it every day. And all of a sudden it was like, you know, I could handle the ball, you know, well at a young age. And, you know, I'd go play with kids in the neighborhood that were quite a bit older than me. And obviously when you're smaller and slower, and, that's the way that you compete, is just, you have to be able to do things better than the competition. So, I was fortunate. I had a Phi Ed teacher. His name was Kevin Orr, tremendous guy. And what was crazy is that Coach Orr actually coached several high schools, Illinois and Wisconsin, and actually had the chance to coach the Ellenson brothers. Wally was the older one, played at Marquette, and then his younger brother Henry was a one and done at Marquette, drafted in the first round by the Detroit Pistons. And so from a young age, I was inspired by a guy that loved basketball, and kind of the karma in that story is that he eventually got to coach, you know, first round draft pick. And it's pretty special seeing him at the Barclays Center at the NBA draft when Henry Ellenson was drafted. But he kind of inspired me to start working out at home, to work on my game, to figure out what I could do that other kids wouldn't be able to do. And then just the passion kind of took off from there.
So what was it about the game of basketball? Did you play other sports when you were a kid, or what made basketball stand out to you compared to other sports?
Yeah, I played everything, and I still do. I mean, I love football. I played tennis. I ran track. I think my first competitive athletic experience, I talk about it a bit in the book, but I signed up to run in our city track club when I was 7 years old. And it was fun because I got to do all the different events and a lot of the field events. So I'd just go screw around and jump on the high jump mat and throw shot puts all over the place. But the beauty of that whole experience was that I was around a lot of kids that were older than me, several of which, again, being in a town of 18,000 people, ended up having phenomenal sports careers. So I was 2 years younger than a kid named Adam Stenovich, who would go on to be the left tackle at Michigan for 3 years. He then went on to play in the NFL for a few seasons. He was actually just hired as the Green Bay Packers offensive line coach. So I was next to him. And then the kid on the other side of me was tall and skinny and actually ended up winning a gold medal in the Athens Olympic Games in the 400-meter dash. So I was fortunate to be around people that, quite honestly, were ended up being world-class athletes at what they chose to do. And so just even that competitive drive that I saw at the age of 7 years old, I think just showed me what it was like to want to be great at something. And so started with track, and then eventually I was like, you know, running's fun, but it's just running. And so I loved the fact that I could actually improve as a basketball player by myself. And I think that's what set basketball apart for me, was that, you know, I didn't have to round people up to practice. I didn't have to find a partner to throw a football with. I mean, I could literally go out in the driveway by myself. I could go in the basement, you know, by myself during the winter and just work on stuff and improve myself as a basketball player, as an athlete. And so I think that was kind of the thing about basketball that I ultimately looked at myself and said, here's a sport where if I truly put in the work and only I can, you know, look at what I did at the end of the day, I'm going to see results and I'm going to be able to look back and say, I kind of control my own destiny.
I think that's one of the great things about the game of basketball is the fact that you can improve on your own. You don't need a bunch of friends. Obviously you can get people together and play some games on the driveway or in the neighborhood, especially when you're a young kid, but the ability to just go into your basement or go into your garage or just be out on your driveway by yourself shooting baskets is something that, you know, in a lot of other sports, it's just not feasible to be able to do. And to your point, when you're somebody that has a work ethic and has a drive, you know, you can make a tremendous amount of improvement in a short period of time just by putting in that kind of work. And so I can totally relate to, you know, your description of why you fell in love with the game of basketball. And so as you continue to grow in the game, you had an opportunity, I know from reading your book, that you got a chance to play some AAU basketball. So can you describe a little bit about your experiences playing AAU basketball and what you think are some of the strengths and weaknesses maybe of the current AAU system that we have today?
So I started playing AAU basketball when I was about 15. I was a freshman in high school. And at the time, because again, I was in a pretty small town, we didn't have any teams even within a 2-hour driving distance of where I lived. So I ended up joining a squad in Appleton, Wisconsin called the Fox Valley Skills. It was the first Reebok sponsored basketball club in the state of Wisconsin, which is kind of crazy because Reebok just wasn't super involved in basketball at that time. But we had a kid on our team named Brian Butch who would actually go on to be a McDonald's All-American, played at Wisconsin. They called him the Polar Bear. But he was a legit 6'11", you know, he was 15 years old. So that year was a tremendous experience just because we got to travel all over the country. We played against some awesome players, guys like Shannon Brown. We played against LeBron's team, but he wasn't actually playing in that game. And then we got to go to Vegas and just play in front of, you know, every college coach in the country. I mean, I loved it. I continued to play AAU after that, and the exposure, you know, I kind of think speaks for itself. But at the end of the day, my love was never for AAU, and not because I didn't enjoy playing the games or I didn't like the camaraderie with guys that I didn't get to play with during the school year, but I was always just kind of a drill guy. I mean, I love going to small gyms. I love being out on my driveway. I loved kind of just putting in the work of just improving. And then, you know, I guess I'd rather spend more time working on those types of things than just playing in 1,000 games. So I think my biggest criticism probably today of AAU basketball is just simply that. I mean, if you don't need 500 games in a summer, you just don't need that much. You'd probably be better off, you know, playing 20 games max and just working on the things you actually need to improve on. And then, you know, being able to obviously like showcase those things in the game. But I think it's just kind of gotten blown out of proportion a little bit. And some exposure is great. It's motivating. But I ultimately prefer to be in the gym.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's one of the drawbacks of the system today is, you know, kids just are playing so many games that are not getting themselves in the gym and practicing in the same way that you did or maybe I did back in the day, where you're just with your, you know, with your ball at your basket and just working on different skills. Instead, you know, kids are playing all the time and they're not really getting much practice time. And I've had this conversation with some other coaches that have been on the show with us that, you know, if you go to a weekend tournament, you know, if you're not the best player or you're not the point guard, how much time are you actually spending with the ball in your hands over the course of 4 or 5 games that you might play in a, you know, in a weekend tournament? And the answer is not very much. And so you'd probably be better served, again, to your point, playing a, you know, a lesser schedule, but spending more time in the gym with the ball in your hands and actually working on skills that then can translate back to your, you know, whether it's your middle school, your high school career, whatever the case may be. Talk a little bit about your experience in high school, kind of leading into your recruitment and what ended up, you know, weighing on your decision to go to Crookston. And then obviously you touched on it a little bit earlier, just, you know, how you kind of started journaling while you were there. So talk a little bit about that, you know, your high school experience and then your recruitment.
So I was a 3-time all area, all conference player. You know, I had a great high school experience. I think my only regret is that I grew up playing with a group of guys from about 4th grade on. And after my freshman year, I decided to transfer from a private school to a public school, mostly for academic reasons, and also purely for the fact that the public school was right next to my house. So it just made sense for me and my family. But I think the most challenging part with that was that I had a great bond with those guys. We had really, really good teams, and several of those kids would go on to play college athletics, both in basketball and football. And so just looking back, that private school team went to the state tournament when I was a senior. Would have been great, obviously, to go and participate in that. And I always kind of look back at that and think what if. But our public school team in its own right was very, very good. My senior year, we lost 3 games, and they were all to the same team, twice during the regular season and again in the sectionals. And so no regrets there. They were probably just a better team than us, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
But it was a tough way to go down when you're just like, God, we got to get past these guys to advance. And, you know, we gave it our best shot. We had some really good players, and unfortunately it was just a better team ahead of us. And so when the season ended, I had a lot of interest from Division II and III schools, and, you know, Crookston seemed like the best fit, and also would give me the ability to play early on. And I did. I played quite a bit as a freshman. I had a good experience there. I think the toughest part for me is that I went from a town of 18,000 people to a town of about 8. And so it was even smaller. And it was really just school and basketball for me and my teammates there. And so, you know, when the season ended, it wasn't that I had a bad basketball experience, but it was more, I just kept thinking to myself, like, you know, what do I want to get out of my life? What do I want to get out of my college experience? You know, I had really good grades. I'm like, if I could go to a bigger school, is that something that would interest me even as a student? And so you kind of just weigh all those things and you think to yourself, like, you know, what experience is going to get me eventually to kind of the goals I have for myself as a person? And so that's when I decided to transfer to Marquette.
Gotcha. So let's jump back before we get to your Marquette experience. Can you talk a little bit about your adjustment from high school basketball to college basketball? Like, what do you remember about that time in terms of the adjustment from the level of play in high school to the Division II level there that you were playing at Crookston?
So I think 2 big things stick out. One was that I was given a summer program basically for 12 weeks to accomplish every day. And I showed up, you know, in end of August, basically for orientation. And you know, we kind of joked with some of the assistant coaches and some of my new teammates on who had done what. And, you know, people kind of laughed at me because I was the only guy that actually did the full 12-week program. And at the time, I mean, I had a full-time job. I was mowing lawns and mowing cemeteries. And I mean, it was grueling work. And you guys, obviously in the Midwest, I mean, you know what it's like in the summertime.
Yeah, the humidity is crazy.
So we'd work all day from basically like 6 to 6, and I'd get done and I'd do my own basketball stuff, and then I would go do this conditioning program every night. And there were a lot of days when I just thought, you know, why am I doing this? But I was obviously, you know, I was driven, and I wanted to show up in shape, and also wanted to show the coaching staff that they had made the right investment in me. And so, I mean, I showed up kind of ready to go, and I had a great preseason in terms of just conditioning. I think that's one thing that was shocking. I think maybe not so much to me, but to a lot of my teammates, was just, you know, we were out on a running track. We were out on a football field probably 4 or 5 days a week. And some of those workouts are brutal. I mean, it seems like it never ends. But I think it would always go back to, they wanted to make the most conditioned guy hurt. And so, I mean, if you're not in good condition coming into the preseason, you're going to be in a world of hurt, literally. So I always tell people, like, you know, people talk about conditioning as a way to get in shape, but I mean, you better be in shape when you come to conditioning. Otherwise, you're going to have a rough time.
Yeah, it's not going to be too much fun for you, for sure. Were you surprised that at the college level, that when you came back and you're like, oh, you're all hyped up that you did your 12-week program, and, you know, the rest of your team's looking at you like, what are you, crazy? Were you surprised by that? I don't know if lack of dedication is maybe the right way to put it, but were you just surprised that guys weren't taking it as seriously as you were?
For sure. I mean, I think that was kind of just one red flag for me from the get-go, was that, you know, I wanted to be around other competitors. I mean, I thought part of respecting, you know, the guys that you play with is, you know, you look just down the line and you say, hey, all these guys work just as hard, if not harder than I am. You know, they put in the time, they've earned the right to be where they are. And so even just that, you know, kind of that reaction, it was like, you know, do you guys not trust the coaching staff? Is there a reason why you didn't do this stuff? Is it not important? And so I wouldn't say that necessarily like set the wrong tone, but it was certainly a indicator of kind of maybe where the commitment of the rest of those guys were. And then I also just, once we actually started practice, I think the biggest difference, obviously, between high school and college is just the physicality. And some of the rules have changed, even just in how basketball is refereed now. But I think even going back to when you played, I mean, basketball is a rough sport, and especially in practice. You know, we didn't practice like that in high school, where, you know, guys literally get tackled and there were no fouls.
Right. Yeah. No coaching. No coaches are really calling fouls during practice.
No. So it's just like, I mean, you would get absolutely clobbered. You get pushed all over the place, you know, you'd be scratched all over the place. And I think that was kind of the biggest adjustment for me. Even just bringing the ball up the floor, sometimes it was like, you know, guys would literally like shove me out of bounds, you know, and the coaches would call a turnover and basically give the ball to the other team. And you just shake your head like, this is absolutely crazy. But that's just kind of the way it was. And eventually you kind of get used to it, and you just don't let yourself get pushed out of bounds. So it was definitely took some adjusting, but you figure it out.
Yeah, I think there's a huge adjustment in the physicality. You know, you go from, you know, most guys that are playing in college are the best player on their team or the second best player on their team, probably at worst. And, you know, you go to college and now everybody's in that same position. And so that physicality and size is a huge adjustment for any player. And I don't care if you're going from high school to Division I or you're going from high school to Division III. There's still a huge adjustment in terms of that. And not just the physicality of the players from a pushing you around standpoint, but kind of what you mentioned, just in terms of what's demanded of you and what's demanded of your body at that level is such a huge jump up from high school. And the other thing that, you know, we just talked about here that I always find to be interesting is, you know, you, I think there's a perception out there that you get to, you know, a certain level of basketball and that every player that you play with on the college level is a super dedicated player like you were. And you come to find out that when you play that, that's oftentimes not the case, whether it's players on your own team or you talk to guys from that play on other teams. And they're like, oh yeah, this guy doesn't do this or he doesn't do that. And it's just interesting when you get to that level, you know, I think the outside perception is that everybody's, you know, gung ho and working on their game all the time. And you realize it's just like any other level of basketball. There are some guys who take it super serious and work on their game all the time. And then there's other guys who, you know, are just kind of floating and doing the things, you know, they're laughing about, oh, I didn't do that 12-week program.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's just, it's crazy how you think back your whole life to like the kids that would always ask like, you know, hey, when's the practice going to end? Or, you know, as soon as the coach turns their back, they do what they're not supposed to be doing. Or if the strength coach tells you to do 10 and they do 8.
Right. Absolutely.
It's been like that your whole life. And I think even now, you know, in my business career, it's like I work with a lot of awesome people, but it's the same thing.
Yep.
And it's like, you know, we have younger managers and people, you know, they'll literally voice their complaints about so-and-so not working hard. And it's like, that's just the way it is. But I think ultimately at the end of the day, you know, you cannot, you know, the work you put in, you can't lie to yourself. And, you know, I mean, obviously losing for some of us hurts a lot more just because we know what we put in. And, you know, when you take shortcuts, whether in practice or, you know, in business or life or whatever, eventually that stuff catches up to you and you kind of get what you get the results that you deserve.
Yeah, you sure do. And I think being self-aware of, again, how much time you're putting in and the amount of work that you put in. I was always a person, again, that I wasn't the fastest, I wasn't the quickest, I wasn't the biggest. And so I had to rely on, similar to what your story is, you had to rely on your work ethic and your ability to, you know, be in great physical condition and be very, very skilled, because I didn't necessarily have the athleticism that some of the guys that I was competing against day in and day out had. And so I always looked at people who had more, quote, natural ability maybe than I did, and always wondered, how do you not try to maximize whatever that natural ability is? But to your point, no matter where you're at, whether it's your job, whether it's in school, whether it's on the basketball court, there are always people who do more with less, and there's always people who do less with more.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about how you end up at Marquette. So you're making the decision there at Crookston after you're there for a year. You know, you're thinking, looking around going, I don't know if I want to spend the next 3 years here with just class and basketball, and that's all there is to do. So I know you grew up kind of, you know, having an eye on the Marquette program growing up in Wisconsin, and obviously, you know, the tremendous history there with, you know, Al McGuire and Rick Majerus, and just the success that the program has had over the years. So how do you make the decision that you're going to go ahead and transfer to Marquette, and tell people how you ended up having an opportunity to actually become a member of the team there?
It was actually a really easy decision for me. I knew I wanted to go closer to home. At the end of the day, I was either going to go to Wisconsin or Marquette. But for me, my father was actually a student at Marquette in the 70s. And he was a sophomore during the 1977 national title run. And from a very young age, you know, basketball games were on TV probably two or three nights a week at my house. And it was always Marquette. And so, I mean, I didn't just grow up watching college basketball. I grew up watching, you know, Mike Dean and Kevin O'Neill. And, you know, some of my earliest memories were not necessarily emulating Michael Jordan out of my driveway, but, you know, guys like Aaron Hutchins, who was point guard at Marquette, Tony Miller, Damon Key. So I had kind of that just Marquette blood on it, honestly, from an early age. And I thought, you know, it's weird because my parents both worked really hard, and I was the oldest of four kids. And I'll be honest, I never thought Marquette was in the cards for us, even financially. I thought, you know, here I got money to go to college my freshman year. I was playing basketball even better. But, you know, I think a lot of kids like keep that in the back of their head of just, you know, it's really expensive to go to Marquette. And how am I going to make this work? And so once I was able to kind of work out the financial piece of it and just say, this is an investment that I want to make in myself and it's worth it to me. Then I kind of started to think about the basketball side of things. And at first, I had really just told myself that any way I could contribute to the team, and again, I was not planning on playing, would be an honor for me. And so I actually emailed Tom Crean directly and just said, I'd love to help out in any capacity, whether that's as a manager in the film room. If you need me, I'll be there. And so he encouraged me to get in touch with some of the assistant coaches and to start working basketball camps. And I did all of those things. And then one random day, I actually would scrimmage with a lot of the camp coaches, and occasionally some of the assistant coaches would play as well at nighttime after camp was over. And I'll never forget, you know, Brian Wardle was a great player at Marquette. He's now the head coach at Bradley, but he was the director of basketball operations at the time. And he just came up to me and said, you know, we're looking for another walk-on, and we think you'd be a great fit here, but you're going to have to earn it. And, you know, this was probably mid-July. And so he essentially told me to come back in 30 days and that they'd set up some individual workouts for me with the coaching staff, and that I better be ready to give it everything I have. And so that's what I did. And I essentially went home after that set of kind of 4 or 5 weeks of camp was over. And I became a permanent resident at a small Catholic school gym that I grew up in. And it was almost a therapeutic time for me, to be honest, because here I was every single day during the month of August in that gym by myself. I go in the mornings, I'd be there all night, and it was always just myself. And so I mentally felt like I was just in a really good place kind of after that 30 days, because I had put in the time. I was confident. And so that's kind of when I went back to school and started the workouts with the coaching staff. And I think one quick story I'll share was just the second workout I was in, we were running at the end, and we had probably been running for more than 20 minutes, and we were running these sprints called 22s, where it was down, back in under 22 seconds, which most people can complete a couple of those, but by the third or fourth, you really got to push it to get to the finish line in under 22. And we just kept running them sprint after sprint after sprint. And I'll never forget this, because there was a guy right next to me, it was me and one other player, who literally got to the point where he just quit. He collapsed on the baseline and kind of inched his way up against the wall and just gave the coaches an indicator, kind of like, I'm done, like no more. And I couldn't believe it, because this guy was, again, he was bigger, he was faster, he was just honestly was probably a better athlete than I was. But to see somebody like that kind of physically and mentally just quit was kind of crazy. But I also knew at that point that, you know, my mentality was just one at a time, and I was going to run as many sprints as I needed to until they really told me to stop. And so I think just having the mentality of like, you know, I've done this kind of all my life. I put in the time and effort. And at the end of the day, I just, you know, I got to stay mentally tough and just worry about myself.
And they kind of set those workouts out with the, you know, set them up with the idea of, we're going to make it so tough that these guys are going to quit, because they wanted to see whether or not you'd be able to handle going through and actually being a part of the team, correct?
Correct. And the crazy part about it is that I would never go through another workout as hard as probably those three as walk-on, you know, tryouts, the rest of the season as a actual player. And so they were absolutely brutal. And to your point, I mean, we had a bunch of guys drop out. I think, you know, the story I just told was memorable just because, this guy was clearly like a candidate to take that spot. And I thought, man, I mean, I'm going to give it everything I have, but realistically, like, some of these guys might just be better than me. So to see guys kind of mentally give up, it gave me some confidence. And I think it also just proved to the coaching staff that, I think one thing that one piece of advice I would give high school players that, you know, have any ambition of walking on or even just being a part of a college program is that, now these coaches want, number one, they want kids that are just bought in. Two, they want kids that are really going to push their players. And so given those two things, it's not always the most talented basketball player that's going to make those teams. You know, it's the guy that's going to like get after it to the very end. And I think, so I think that's one thing that just really stood out and became more apparent to me even as I went through the workouts of like, you know, what kind of character is this person and are they going to be a good fit on our club?
Yeah, I think mental toughness and coachability are two huge pieces of what any coach, if you're, especially if you're talking about from a walk-on perspective, you know, you want somebody who's going to be able to withstand the rigors of being at practice. And, you know, I can speak to this to some degree. When I was a freshman, I played very, very little. And those were some of the most difficult practices of my career, because you knew that you had to work just as hard as the player who was going to play 35 minutes the next night. You were working just as hard as they were, and yet you might only see 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 0 minutes in some cases. And so I think that that mental toughness of knowing, hey, I'm not going to play in the games most likely, but I still have to be out here giving everything I have in the practices. That's something that I think is very difficult for, again, for the average person, A, to be able to understand what that's like, and then B, to actually be able to do that on a day-to-day basis is something that, you know, again, as a walk-on, you face every single day.
Absolutely. I think one vivid memory for me was we were playing in a game at home in Milwaukee, and we were losing at halftime, and our entire team was just kind of down. I mean, it was a game we should have been winning, but we came out kind of sluggish, and we never really got around to playing good basketball, and all of a sudden it was halftime, we were losing. But locker room's kind of quiet. Eventually the coaching staff comes into the room, and the first thing Tom Crean says is, John Wilkham, stand up. And I'm not even dressed for the game. So I'm wearing dress clothes, and I'm thinking, why in the world would this guy be calling me out? And so I stand up in the middle of a room surrounded by the rest of the team, and he basically just berates me about my performance in practice during the week and the fact that, you know, it was my effort, it was my screwing around, not understanding the game plan, not studying the scouting report. I didn't prepare, you know, our backcourt the way that I should have, blah, blah, blah. And then he just storms out of the room. And of course, you're standing there just in complete shock. Like, okay, you know, I haven't played, but I guess that makes sense.
Right, exactly.
So at the time, you're a little embarrassed. And I can laugh about this now because he leaves the room. We had an All-American point guard named Travis Diener at the time who literally looks at me and just starts laughing. And he's just like, you know, every time I play bad the rest of the season, it's going to be your fault. And so we got a kick out of that. But, I mean, looking back at that now, it showed me that Crean actually cared about my contribution. And I think that, you know, those are the moments where I said, you know, why am I doing this? Is it worth it? You know, is the time and the effort and all of this that I'm kind of putting into the program, like, what am I actually getting out of this? Again, in a subtle way, Crean was basically saying, like, you know, you're just as important to this team as everybody else. And he obviously valued my contribution. And so I thought that was an interesting coaching tactic, but something that years later I'd probably institute myself.
Yeah, I think that was one of the stories that stood out for me from your book, just from a standpoint of, I think one of the things that, especially at the college level, it seems, and I know I experienced this to a certain degree, there are some things that college coaches do, and this is your story right there is one of them, that there's a psychological aspect to some of the things and the way that they approach certain players or certain teams or certain situations. And, you know, a lot of times as a player, you don't necessarily see that or understand it in the moment. And I'm sure, the day you were standing there and he's yelling at you and you're looking around going, dude, I don't even play. Like, why are you picking me out and singling me out of everybody as you're standing there? And then again, now looking back on it, you can kind of see that, you know, you see it from a different perspective. And I always think it's interesting, or it would be interesting, to be able to kind of pick the brain of, you know, a coach in that situation and say, what really were you trying to accomplish with, you know, with that particular tactic? Because it wasn't to call you out probably in terms of, you know, your actual performance. There was some, you know, some other motivation, obviously, to help the other guys that were on the team that were playing and, you know, to help the team get better. But it's just, it would be interesting to hear what the perspective was of why, you know, he chose that particular moment and chose you at that particular moment to be able to inspire the rest of the team and inspire you to, you know, continue to improve and get better.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because having been on the other end now as a coach, and especially like at the high school level, when you got multiple guys in a room, you know, kids go to the locker room at halftime, usually the coaches gather in like a separate room. To your point, you talk about like what you're going to come back and tell the group. And so, yeah, I just kind of wondered that was that something that Coach Crane and the rest of the assistants, you know, brainstormed during their, I guess, 5 minutes in a separate room? Or was it something where he just basically told those guys, I'll get to that, and did it himself? I guess I'll never probably know that. But yeah, interesting from that perspective.
Yeah, for sure. We had Fran Fischel on, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, and he shared a story of when he was in Manhattan, and he was in the middle of the season in February, and he wanted to give his team a day off, but he didn't just want to give them a day off. And so he went down and, you know, they practiced for 5 minutes and somebody turned the ball over and he started screaming at them. It was like, you guys are terrible. You know, you think you're way better than you are, and kicks them all out of practice. And then he goes up, you know, goes up to the coach's office, and he and the coaches are laughing, huh? You know, like, we gave him the day off. They don't realize it. And then little did they know that the team actually stayed. The managers came up later and said, hey, the guys are down there practicing. And Fran's point there was, you know, hey, you know, that wasn't what I intended, but these guys really took ownership of, you know, he didn't see that part of it coming, but he goes, like, the team really took ownership of, you know, of the season. And that's when I knew I really had, you know, something going. And so again, could he have just said, hey guys, you got a day off, as opposed to, you know, coming in and going for 5 minutes and, you know, putting on the whole charade of, we're going to, you know, we're going to kick him out of practice. It's just interesting, the psychology of what he was thinking behind the scenes, you know, to hear that. I could tell you a story that I don't think I've told this one on the podcast yet, but one time when I was at Kent and we were losing a game at halftime, and I can't even remember who we were playing, but coach came in and he always had this little, and it was almost like a little nightstand that he would come in, he would set his clipboard on, and he had some paper and, you know, pencils like on a little shelf that was on this thing. And he came in at halftime and he took all the things that were on this little shelf and took them off the shelf and put them on the side. And then he was going through his halftime and getting more and more worked up. And then by the end of his halftime speech, he picked up this shelf and chucked it against the wall. And, you know, and then, you know, at the time when he was clearing it off, you weren't really thinking about it. But then after the fact, like after the game, we're all like, do you remember Coach taking stuff off the shelf before, you know, before he started talking? And so again, it would be interesting to be able to hear what the perspective was of, you know, why did he go about doing it that way? And what did he think that the throwing of the shelf was going to do to motivate us as a team? Those are all things that these little psychological, you know, trying to get an edge or whatever it is, or try to motivate a particular team. I always find it to be an interesting piece of what coaches do. And I thought there were a couple moments in your book that kind of illustrated that. And the one that you described with, you know, Crane yelling at you there in the locker room was something that, you know, really jumped out at me and made me remember some of the times that I experienced when I was playing.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start basketball camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the other things that you experienced while you were there, you know, in terms of the practice situation and just how Coach Crean would go ahead and during practice. I know you mentioned sometimes that, you know, the language compared to some of the language with, you know, some of your other coaches that you were maybe used to in a different way. That's one of the things that I think people who are on the outside don't always understand, you know, especially nowadays, the colorful language that coaches use occasionally.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely, and we talked about transition from high school to college, and every college coach is different. Every culture is different. I think one thing that was so interesting just about Marquette is that we had really long practices, and we didn't, you know, break any NCAA rules or it wasn't anything like that, but it was more like Steve Novak was a good friend of mine. Has gone on to have a tremendous NBA career, and he just retired last year. But and he would always talk about he strongly considered going to Syracuse, and Jim Boeheim, you know, would basically told him that, hey, once we get into February, practices are an hour and a half max. It was basically like we start out at the NCAA limit per day, and that over time we come down. So that by the time we're heading into tournament play, we're not going to be practicing a lot. Opposite was kind of Marquette, which is every day was, you know, 3-hour practices. And they were long and they were hard. And so it was it definitely took a toll on kind of your body, but even just your mind of, man, you know, it's the day before a game, or we used to joke around about shoot arounds. Cause it was never, we didn't ever do any shooting. you know, we literally would have a full practice on game day, and some of these, you know, practices would last more than 2 hours. And by the time you're done, you sit down and you're like,
right, wow. I got to play. I'm going to have to try to play it. Well, and you know, for your situation, you know, you weren't having to play, but you wonder the guys who were playing 35 or 40 minutes. We would do the same thing at Kent, to be honest with you. Our practice would be a little bit shorter on game day, but we would go through a full, you know, regular practice. And we rarely practiced, you know, less than 2.5 hours all the way through the season. I wonder with the advent of sort of the analytics and having a better understanding of the need for recovery, I wonder if, you know, at Georgia, if Coach Crean has changed, you know, kind of his outlook on that at all. It'd be interesting to find out.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one story that I told this briefly in the book as well, but, we had Arizona playing in Milwaukee in December, and it was a 12 o'clock tip on a Saturday. And, traditionally we would always take shoot around first, obviously to get the most rest before game time. But in this case, we made Arizona come in at like 7 a.m. and we took the 8 o'clock slot. And, you know, it's probably 7:45, and those guys literally are just shooting all over the place. And, Lute Olson comes over while some of us are putting our shoes on and just starts joking around. And I sat there just kind of smiling because he's talking about weather and all these random things about Milwaukee and not even paying attention to like what his guys are doing during shoot around. And I thought, you know, this couldn't be more of just the opposite of what, you know, right, we're gonna go through in 15 minutes, which was very, very regimented, you know, every 5 minutes from moving from one drill to the next. So it's just very different philosophies. And, you know, we lost that day to an awesome Arizona team. I mean, they had 3 or 4 pros on that team. But it was just, it was interesting to kind of see the clashes of culture where there's so many different ways to win. And at the end of the day, there's so many different ways to get the respect of your guys. And so I, you know, as an older person now, looking back to when high school kids talk about recruiting and relationships with coaches. And I think that's also important stuff to look at is just, You know, what type of style do you want to be involved in, and what type of demeanor does your coach have? Because some people, you know, some people thrive under, you know, very disciplined, you know, kind of grinded out type of mentality. Other people are just, you know, they're just more chill individuals, and they're not going to survive in that type of culture. So it's crazy to see the different ways you can have success.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things I think would be really interesting, and it's one of the things that I always wondered about while I was playing, is just what those different styles, what different programs were like. And, you know, obviously, you know, your own program inside and out, and the way that your coaching staff does things, and the way your practices run, and the, what you do on game day, and what you eat for your pregame meal and all that stuff. But it would be very interesting to be able to travel back in a time machine and kind of go and observe what practices were like at different schools that you played against and with guys that, you know, you competed against, just to see how different those different styles could be. Because I think there's lots of different ways to be able to win games, and there's lots of different styles of coaching. I think it would be a really fun way to go back and look at how all these different coaches over the course of time have coached. And then today, I think about, you know, high school kids being able to figure out where, you know, where they're going to go and what the coaching staff is like. I think that's probably easier to figure out now than it was certainly when I was playing, when there was no internet. Now, I think it's pretty, you can get a pretty good read on what kind of coach, you know, what kind of person it is, that what kind of program you're signing with, versus back in, you know, the late 80s when I was coming out of high school. You know, you maybe went on your recruiting visit, and guys would, you'd stay with them for your visit, and they might tell you one thing, and then you'd find out that maybe that wasn't exactly 100% what it was actually sure. like. So it would be a lot of fun. I guess my point is, it'd be a lot of fun to be able to go back and just see what other practices were like in other programs during the era while you played, just to get a comparison for, you know, okay, here we are at Marquette. We're practicing 3 hours on a, you know, on a Wednesday in February. And, you know, here's Arizona, and they're practicing for an hour and 10 minutes. And it's, you know, it's a far more, you know, again, not casual is maybe the wrong word, but it's just a different style of play and a different style of coaching.
Yeah. And I mean, I've been around a lot of coaches, I guess during my time at Marquette, but also just after that. And it really is just fascinating to me, because I've seen so many different just drills. And we talked about psychology earlier. It's kind of the mind games that some of these coaches play with players. And some are just, you know, all in your face, and others are just kind of let you figure it out. You know, I read Pat Summitt's book a few months ago, and even just the way that she treated some of her leaders, of basically telling them, like, she had a point guard, and I think it was Michelle Marciniak in the 90s, who, good player, senior leader, but basically February, she threatened to bench her, and then she actually did bench her, and then she went as far as to basically tell her, we're kicking off the team. And there wasn't any, like, violation of team rules, or, I mean, she was a great player, great teammate, everybody loved her. But just to prove to her, like, unless you step it up and play at an elite level, we basically don't want you here. And I thought, wow, like, number one,
amazing.
I would never do that. I would never do that. But again, that's me. And I think that it's so interesting. Like, you got to have an unbelievable trust, and both sides, for number one, as a player to say, gosh, is he really going to kick me off the team? And not just to give up on the coach in the season, because that could go downhill really quick. And also, if you're Pat Summitt, to know that, is this going to be a, you know, a problem the rest of the year? Because
right, she's just going to walk away. Maybe she just hands you your uniform and walks off.
Exactly. And then, you know, Pat Summitt went on to explain that, I knew Michelle's parents, and I knew that they would never let her quit. And so it's like, wow. I mean, you have to obviously, like, you got to know that stuff, because crazy thing is, Tennessee went on to win the national title. And so I guess that's what made Pat Summitt a legend. And, you know, you read about it later in a book and you're like, it's crazy. But those are kind of some of the extreme things that go on behind the scenes when, you know, we're watching a national title being celebrated on TV, not knowing that girl that just hit those free throws was basically kicked off the team a month ago.
Right. Exactly. Well, to that end, talk a little bit about your relationship with your strength coach at Marquette, because I that was some of the I found a lot of those stories in the book to be quite entertaining as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what, that guy got the absolute most out of me. And I look back at those times, and honestly, I don't know how I survived some of the days, to be quite honest with you. I mean, there were literally workouts where I would get done with a leg press, a variation of multiple sets, and I would try to stand up and literally just collapse to the ground. I mean, I couldn't even stand back up. And I'm thinking, like, this isn't normal,
Is this supposed to be helping me?
exactly, And so there were things that almost just scared you because you're like, this shouldn't be physically happening to me. But I'll tell you what, like, the guy pushed me harder than I've ever been pushed, and I've been pushed pretty hard, before my time at Marquette. So it wasn't that I was allergic to hard work by any means. That had kind of been my mantra just as an athlete of, I have to outwork people, otherwise I'm not going to be here. And so to get to a place like that where I had always been, one of the hardest workers, if not the hardest, and then to have someone that just says, we got to turn this up a big notch, and you're like, what could that possibly mean? And we would do things where he would calculate. I mean, we had this climbing machine called the VersaClimber. It's almost like it's like climbing up a wall with your hands and your feet. And you have to climb so many feet in a set prescribed amount of time. And this guy would set these limits where he'd say, you got to climb 3,000 feet in 20 minutes. And it's like, okay, that's fine. And I would give everything I possibly had, and I would finish at like 3,002 feet. And it's like, holy cow. Like, I don't know if I could ever do that again, but I would go on to do it, probably 50 plus times, where he knew exactly like what all out effort was going to result in. And so there were just so many examples like that where, I mean, I was deathly afraid of this guy, but by the end of the season, I mean, I saw it in my own body. I mean, I was probably 155 pounds when I showed up. 15, 16% body fat. I mean, in April when he measured me and I was like 172 pounds and 4-something% body fat. I mean, and I was eating dorm food every day. So knowing what I know now about just, your diet's a huge part of all of that, and I was eating terrible food. And I still look like that and have those types of results, without taking a, single vitamin or supplement or anything to enhance myself that way. It was just straight up hard work.
Yeah, I just love the stories of, you're on the leg press and you're at about rep 12 and you think you're done, and then you're looking around and he's like, "Hey, give me 20." And that's just, those kinds of things are things that again, I don't think the average high school player, the average fan, the average parent, to your point about being behind the scenes, those are things that are unseen, but that are a part of, I would venture to guess, every major program around the country, that there's, whether it's, again, a strength and conditioning coach, an assistant coach, a head coach, that's pushing kids to their absolute limit. And again, there's lots of different ways that you can do that, whether it's some of the psychological things that we talked about earlier, whether it's the physical things that we're talking about now. Again, it's all designed to get results and to produce the best potential athletes, and then as a result of that, wins on the scoreboard, which is unfortunately how coaches are ultimately judged.
Yeah, I think it's crazy because for 6 straight months he didn't say like one nice thing to me, and so it's so funny when you look back at those times, and you're like, God, does this guy just absolutely hate me? But then, I think the crazy part for me was that we were doing spring workouts after the season, and Scott knew I was committed, and I think by that point I'd hopefully earned at least some of his respect. but it's like you never really know kind of where you stand. And I was sitting in the cafeteria one day, and a bunch of men's soccer players came up to me and sat down, and we ate lunch together. And, you know, they were telling me that they just got done working out with Scott. And I thought, you know, oh, brother, like, you know, what stories are they going to tell me, or what are they going to say? And they said that they actually started their workout by him telling the soccer team that if those guys, you know, worked half as hard as John Wilkham, they'd all be great players. And I thought, there's no way in hell this guy said that. But deep down, I also thought, I can't, if he actually said that, you know, it kind of just proves that he does respect who I am. He respects the effort I put in. He just respects kind of my approach to coming in there every day and doing the best I can. And I think that we had a deadlift competition in the spring, and I was going up against two guys that were much bigger than me. One guy was about 6'8", 225. The other guy was 6'8", probably 260. And those two guys went first, and one guy got like 25 reps. The other guy got probably 28, 29. And I thought, you know, what the hell? I'm going to give this everything I had. And, you know, when I got to 20, I thought maybe I could get 25, you know, and all of a sudden I was at 30. And then by the time I did 35, eventually this whole thing just went crashing to the ground. But it was just one of those days where here I was in some, you know, meaningless deadlift competition that
right.
No one will ever see. And I just, you know, I just beat these guys by quite a bit. And I think, and even Scott was just kind of going crazy in the weight room, because it was almost like, you know, I was the byproduct of all the effort. And I think those guys took great joy in just kind of seeing someone go from what I was when I came in to where I was 6 months later.
Yeah, I think one of the things that struck me too about your book, and it kind of paralleled my experience to a certain degree, and that was that I think what came through was that everybody that was associated with the program there had respect for you and what you were able to do and what you were able to accomplish and the work ethic that you demonstrated while you were there. And yet, unless I missed it or unless I kind of misread what you were going through, it seems like that you didn't necessarily hear that from any of them during the time while the season was going on. It was like they were very reluctant or very reticent with their praise. And that was something that I always felt like I experienced was, you know, you do all this stuff, you'd work hard, and you knew deep down that there was, you know, that the coaching staff respected what you did and what you stood for and, you know, how hard you worked. And yet it was very... it wasn't vocalized very often, I guess, is my point. And I think that it sounds like that was a similar experience for you. Would you agree with that statement?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think it's one thing I've tried to emulate as a manager, as a father, as a husband, even as a coach to high school kids after I got done playing at Marquette, was just, you know, people want to know that you appreciate them. And it doesn't have to be all the time. But I think that, you know, there's little ways to do that without basically, I don't know, giving someone too much praise so they kind of get soft. And I think there's a maturity that comes with accepting that praise or affirmation as well. And, you know, I was certainly at a point where I would have welcomed that. It wouldn't have changed, you know, my approach to anything. It wouldn't have changed the effort or the mentality that I showed up with every day. But, you know, when I, again, would go on to coach in high school, I think people forget sometimes that, you know, you're 18, 19 years old. Nobody at that age is super secure in who they are. You know, you're trying to figure out like who you want to be and who your friends are and what's important to you. And so I think a lot of times coaches kind of take it for granted that we're these built-in kind of mentorship figures. But it's like, you know, what are you doing on a daily basis to kind of let your guard down once in a while and be a mentor, be a friend to really kids, and kind of show these kids like how to live or talk to them about some of their insecurities or the dreams or the visions that they have for what they want to accomplish. That stuff goes so far. And I think that, you know, as young people, I mean, I remember those conversations and like the mentors that I've had, whether they were coaches or somebody else, you know, 20 years later. And ultimately those are the things that you kind of take with you to say, you know, I'm going to pass this stuff on to people that I'm around, or make sure that I kind of live by these principles, because someone conveyed this to me at a younger age, and I saw the value in it. So I think it's super important to affirm a job well done, you know, at the same time without having to like hype praise on somebody and be over the top about it.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think that's one of the things that, if I look back on my college career, that's one of the things that I think was missing, was that relationship building between, you know, between the coaching staff and, you know, the players. In a lot of cases, it felt like there was always a separation, and that separation, I think, made it more difficult for, to be honest, for our team to be as successful as maybe we could have been. And, you know, some of it maybe had to do with praise. Some of it had to do with, I think, the coaching staff trying to psychologically get what the most out of the team that they felt they could. And sure. So they did what they, you know, they did what they felt was the best way to be able to maximize, you know, to maximize the players. But to your point, I think that, you know, sometimes you do have to let your guard down. Sometimes you do have to just realize that, you know, it's still a game. It still has to be, there still has to be some time for, you know, some fun. And I think coaches today, I think it's much more prevalent today versus, you know, you go back to the 80s, you know, you had many more coaches who came up on the Bobby Knight school of coaching. Whereas today, I think that those types of coaches, although they still exist in some places, I don't think that they're as prevalent today as they were, you know, back 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, I read a great article right after the Patriots won the Super Bowl, basically explaining what all of those guys said to each other right after they won. And it's interesting because Bill Belichick obviously has his own style and, you know, would probably be classified more in that old school type of coach. But the first thing he said to Brady was, "I love you." The first thing that Brady says to Julian Edelman is, you know, "I love you, man." And I think that there's just that genuineness in those words of just how tight those guys are, to basically use that language. I think just conveys such a deep respect for, you know, the relationships that those guys have on a daily basis, and the things that they probably talk about behind the scenes in terms of family and injuries and scouting reports and how do we want to do this together and what's it going to take and who do we need to move around and, you know, what plays will work against this particular defense, et cetera. So I thought that was very telling. I think if you were to look at any team and just say, you know, how many teams do that now, you know, versus like waiting until you've maybe won something, or maybe you never win it and then you never have a chance to tell people that, hey, you know, I really do care about you, or I care about this relationship, or it's extremely meaningful to me. That certainly goes a long way, and those are the type of guys you want to line up next to.
Yeah, I think respect is a great choice of words there. Because, you know, we talked earlier about praise, and I think you can obviously go over the top, and there's a limit to how much, you know, how much praise you can give someone before it becomes less meaningful. But I think on the best teams and between the best players, I think that feeling of respect between coaches and players, players and coaches, players and players, coaches and coaches, I think if there's respect, I think that is what enables the team to be able to have moments where we're dead serious and we're focused in and we're dialed in on what we need to do. And yet at the same time, because we respect each other, we know we can have maybe some lighter-hearted moments where, you know, we spend 30 seconds or a minute, you know, telling a joke or having something funny happen. And then we move back to, you know, everybody knows that we're going to get back and be serious again and get ready to compete and do what we need to do. And I think that respect is a great way to kind of capture what the best teams and players and coaches have for one another.
Totally agree with you.
All right, so let's go. You spend your year, you spend your year with Marquette, and then at that point you decide that you're not going to come back and do it a second year. So can you kind of walk through the decision making process for that, and then obviously from there you transition into some coaching. So let's go with what made you make the decision to not go back and go for a second year, and then a little bit of your transition into coaching, and then I want to talk a little bit about your camps that you were able to get up and running.
Sure. So I went through spring workouts and really had a tremendous spring. I mean, I continued to get stronger. My game really expanded, just to be honest. I felt like I was making moves with the ball that I had never made before, and I was starting to just transition to the speed of play at a Division I level where, you know, I could score, you know, routinely being challenged in the lane by guys that were 6'10", 6'11", versus, you know, 6'5", 6'6". And so that was fun for me. I mean, I think the spring was a fun time just to be able to, again, do the things, even going back to my childhood, that I really loved, which is just being in the gym and working on different aspects of your game and spending time with assistant coaches, you know, whether it was with the best players or myself. We tried a lot of things. We worked on different reads off of ball screens. And, you know, I kind of got nicknamed Johnny Blur was Crean's nickname for me, as I would just kind of go flying through ball handling drills. And so we had, I felt like we just had a little bit more fun during the spring. And that was just a great time period for me. And so spring ended, everybody goes home. I had an opportunity to actually go study abroad in Belgium for 4 weeks. And I thought this would be, number one, just an awesome opportunity for me as a student athlete, because I'm never going to be able to study abroad or take a full semester. If I could go do this, you know, as a 4 week like summer school course from, you know, mid-May to mid-June, what a great opportunity. So I signed up, went to Europe, had an awesome experience there, literally came back and flew into Milwaukee on a Sunday morning. There was a Marquette basketball camp that started the next morning on Monday. And to be honest, I probably shouldn't have gone to camp. Not because I didn't want to be there. I absolutely loved being at basketball camps, and we'll talk about kind of the passion I have for that in a minute. But the reason that I shouldn't have gone was, you know, I hadn't touched a basketball in 4 weeks. And when you play at that level, and you as a player would know this, you know, your timing is off. I mean, you just, even though I had worked out when I was there, I had taken, you know, long runs and run sprints at night and tried to keep in good condition. I wasn't in good basketball shape, and I'd be the first to admit that. But so many summer camps at big Division I schools, to be honest, sure, they're about the kids, but they're also a time for college coaches to practice with their team. And so, you know, we would have these periods in the morning that were, you know, so-called demonstrations for the kids, which is basically like an hour practice for us. And so so I showed up and I thought, you know, I'm going to give a great effort here, but, you know, I'm not used to doing this stuff because I haven't done it for a while. And so I didn't have the greatest practice that morning. And Crean just kind of let me have it afterwards. And, you know, being 19 years old, and, you know, you kind of walk away from that hurt in one aspect, just because a big part of what we were always kind of preached to was about just maximizing your opportunities, about, you know, attacking each day, you know, take the abilities that you have, get the most out of them. And I thought, for me personally, you know, going to Europe was absolutely the right decision for me. I mean, I got 3 credits in a summer school course. I got to see the world's first time I left the country. You know, I learned a ton of stuff, to be honest, when I was over there. And I did all that in 4 weeks as opposed to an entire semester. So, and I didn't miss any basketball. So for him to kind of react the way that he did, I was like, you know, whatever. It's one day, it happens. But I felt a tremendous amount of pressure kind of the rest of that week to get myself back into basketball shape. And I talk about that a little bit in the book of just, you know, I spent hours and hours and hours, really the next 5 or 6 days in the gym just by myself. And it was the first time that I kind of started to feel like, you know, why am I doing this? I mean, I want to do well and I want to play better at camp next week. But it just kind of felt like a job at that point. Instead of, you know, I'm truly in this because I want to improve and I feel like I'm getting better and, you know, I might have a shot to play next year. And some of those thoughts were just so distant for me. It was more just like, I have to do this. And so next week rolled around, another camp, another set of kids. And we actually had Dan Hurley, who's the coach at UConn now, was there to basically run these demonstrations. And I had a great week. And Dan Hurley actually sat down with me later in the week and just said, you know, hey, you did a hell of a job. And I really appreciate how hard you work. And I think you're going to compete for playing time in the fall. And here I'm mentally, I was just kind of down, to be honest, because I thought, geez, like, if you kind of know what I've been through the last 7 days, this wasn't a good headspace mentally. And so basically after that camp circuit, I went home, took a couple weeks off, and just kind of started to think about, like, you know, what my future looked like and what did I want to do. And one thing that was really important to me is I wanted to get an internship. I wanted to kind of get a jump start in my career. And I also had a ton of interest in being a coach. So I essentially decided to hang up from my basketball, you know, shoes for coaching, and I ended up coaching at a high school down the street. But I think the most important part about all of it was just I never felt like I was quitting. I felt like I had kind of maximized really the talent that I had, that I put everything out there, that I'd given everything that I could to the program. And I told Coach Crean all that stuff, and he was very complimentary and, you know, wished me the best and offered to help me in any way he could. But I was just a little burnt out, to be honest. And so I think it was important for me that as I started coaching and where I landed was really a blessing as well, because I would go on to coach for just an unbelievable person. But it allowed me to kind of see a different side of basketball and, again, a different way of doing things. And it kind of re-energized me and the passion that I had for the game.
Yeah, I think it had to be really difficult. And, like I said earlier, for myself, when I was a freshman and not playing much, it's difficult to go through that grind day after day after day. And, you know, you got to see yourself improve as a basketball player. You got to see a change in your body. But yet the competitor in you, I'm sure, every time a game rolled around and you didn't get to play, made it really difficult to continue to go back. And I'm sure that played a part in it. And then to your point, when you had a great opportunity to go to Belgium to experience another country, to learn and just be a part of that whole thing, when you come back and then somebody doesn't value that in the same way that you valued it, or at least was valuing something else. It was obviously putting the focus on your basketball skill at that particular moment. You know, I think it probably crystallized things for you and gave you an opportunity to say, hey, I'm ready to move on to the next phase of basketball. And obviously with your coaching, and then you got started with some camps, you know, you were still involved in the game, and it just took you to the next phase of your involvement in the game of basketball.
Yeah. So the camps were just an awesome thing. We actually started my own basketball camp with a friend of mine when I was a senior in high school, more just to take everything that I had learned at other camps and bring it to my hometown. And that first year we rented out our local YMCA. You know, we had a gentleman named Dave MacArthur help us. He's a local high school coach, and the camp was awesome. And by the third year, we had so many kids that we had to rent out multiple facilities, and we were busing kids all over the place. And so by year four, actually, when I was a senior in college, again, so many people were like, well, what are you doing now? And you're not playing, and you must have all this time on your hands. I was planning this summer camp circuit, essentially, where me and some other current and former college players basically traveled around the Midwest. And we had a camp in 13 different cities in the 13 weeks of the summer. And it was just a hell of a summer. It was so fun to be able to just share, stories with kids and all of the drills and things that people brought from different programs and kind of put it into this format was awesome. And, we hired a traveling DJ. So we would have, it was like going to a dance club and a gym. And it was just so much fun. And, I think that's the one thing about coaching is when you're around people that share that passion and that, can sit around with a sub sandwich at lunch and you got 20 minutes before the next group of campers show up. And, we used to argue just about every living thing under the sun. But just have so much fun doing it. Those were definitely special times for me.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. I mean, I think that's kind of what the podcast is sort of like in the sense of, we're getting a chance to talk to lots of different people from all over the country, people that we probably never would have had an opportunity to have conversations with otherwise. And it's just been a blast to be able to hear the perspective of a high school coach from Arizona, a high school coach from Illinois, a high school coach from Georgia, and just hear what these different guys are doing in different parts of the country, both from a culture standpoint, from an X and O standpoint, from how they've built their programs. And it's just been an absolute pleasure for somebody who is a basketball junkie like me to be able to talk and pick the brains of all these different guys that are doing things all over the place. And whether it's camp, whether it's their high school teams that they're coaching, it's just been a lot of fun. And I'm sure that's the same experience that you had when you were out on the camp circuit and being able to talk to people, whether it's, your fellow coaches, whether it's the kids, parents. It's just a blast. The camp setting is fantastic.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's so funny because number one, it makes you feel old, but, a couple years ago, watching the NCAA tournament, there were two guys, Paul Jesperson from Northern Iowa, who actually hit a half court shot to beat Texas in the tournament. And then Matt Thomas was a shooting guard at Iowa State, but both those kids, started coming to camp with me when they were in, fourth grade. And so it really kind of came full circle for me to see those guys making significant impacts, leading their teams to the tournament, Paul hitting a shot still on one shining moment, and kind of an intro as the tournament comes around each year. Those are just kind of the special things that you look back and say, that was so much fun. It was so much fun to be a part of those guys' journey. And just to, what I shared with them then, they share their experiences now playing overseas with me today. So it's interesting how the time you put in as a coach, you're never going to get that back immediately, but I really think the payout is tenfold when you consider down the road the impact that you have on some of these kids' lives and ultimately who they become and what they choose to share back with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's nothing better as a coach than that phone call 10 years from now when, the player calls you up and says, "Hey, coach, I just got a new job," or "I'm getting married," or "I had a kid," or whatever the case might be. I think that's really what, when you know that you've had an impact on the players that you've been able to touch, whether it's through camp, whether it's through, a school team that you coached, that impact doesn't always necessarily show up 30 seconds after you say something or do something. It's that 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road when the kid that you had an impact on looks back and says, "Wow, that coach really gave me something that helped me to improve my life and make myself better as a human being, that just made my life better." And I think there's nothing more satisfying as a coach than that.
Absolutely.
Well, John, before we get out of here, I want to make sure that you get people a chance to share where people can pick up your book. And why don't you go ahead and do that, share how people can reach out to you, and then we'll wrap up the episode after that.
Well, first of all, really appreciate you having me on the podcast. It's been a ton of fun. As you said, just talking basketball and talking basketball, people that are passionate about the game. I love this stuff. So really appreciate it. The book's called Walk On Warrior, Drive, Discipline, and the Will to Win. It's available on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com. And people can follow me on Twitter at John Wilkham. So again, the book was 14 years in the making. It really was a passion project for me. And I thought, you know, if I could take some of these things and even just share them with my kids, or someday they'd look back and say, wow, like, I can't believe Dad did that. I wanted to write it down. And the book came out at the end of September. It's actually been the number one selling basketball book on Amazon for the past 21 weeks, which is crazy because this whole thing has been, this is a self-published book. I mean, this is something that, I worked on at nighttime, really for the last 2 years to put it together, to make it into something tangible and something that people might be interested in. So it's been so fun to get feedback from other people about the book, and you know, people share stories about their own basketball careers or people they know from the book or gyms they played in. So I'd love to hear any feedback, good or bad, about the book, and also just encourage people to continue to share their basketball stories and memories with me, because I love hearing it, and it definitely brings a smile to my day.
Yeah, I love the book. It brought back, like I said, a lot of good memories for me, just in terms of different things that I experienced while I was playing. And I think it's a great resource for high school players and for high school parents. If you're interested in finding out sort of what the real world of college basketball is like, I think your book does an excellent job through the different snippets and stories that you were able to share and remember of laying out a realistic picture of what it's like to be part of a program. So for that, I want to say thank you, because I'm very appreciative. Like I said, I wish I would have been as resourceful as you back in the day and wrote down some of my stories, because I think I think you've done a great job with the book. So I would encourage anybody who's out there listening to go out and pick up a copy of Walk On Warrior. I think it's just I think it's a great read. So, John, we can't thank you enough for jumping on the podcast with us tonight. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have four different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.